Hi. How are you? Good. Good to hear it. See, we have a lot of visitors today. I'd like to say welcome. See Mr. Edel back there. Hello, Mr. Edel. Welcome back. Maybe we should make all of our visitors stand up and introduce themselves. Maybe? Nah. We'll skip it this week. Well, my wife and I and the family, we took a little break last week and decided just to get away for a little bit. We went up to Whidbey for a couple of days and just in a little cabin just to kind of recharge. So we just hung out in a little cabin and saw kind of a couple of bald eagles and things like that. So just kind of a, I wouldn't call it exactly stress-free, but it was very nice and relaxing. It was good. So sorry about the Bible study. We'll have to postpone that probably till the next schedule. I just couldn't quite fit it in this week preparing both of these. So let me talk to you today about something. Let's turn first to Luke 18, verse 7. And read a scripture that Christ puts out to us. And he says a very interesting statement in this scripture that I think a lot of times we just kind of read over. It's Luke 18, verses 7 through 8. And it says, And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? In verse 8 it says, I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Now, I know we read that, and a lot of times we just kind of answer right away and say, yeah, of course. Right? Of course Christ is going to find faith on the earth because we're here. You know, we're his church. There's going to be faith. But Christ doesn't idly say statements. He doesn't idly give parables. He doesn't just kind of throw them out there for us to answer a quick yes. There's actually a reason why he says this, and I think it should give us pause to stop and think. You know, if Christ said a statement like that, there must be something behind it. There must be some reason why he said that. Otherwise, he wouldn't just kind of throw those words in the Bible for us to read right over. But I think what it's really saying is that there is a possibility, or at the end of times, it's possible for the way the circumstances will be, that there is a possibility of not having faith at that time. I think that there could be a possibility. You notice the context of when this is actually it says, when the Son of Man comes, or when he returns back to this earth, will he find faith on this earth? And so him saying that is saying that there is a possibility of that happening. And what does that mean? Because let's dig into that. So I think it's very important to understand what this means, because it has big implications for us. It has big implications for us right now, during the next week, and what we do over the coming years. Let's kind of take a look at some of the things that will be happening in the end time and why they require faith. Let's dig into the subject of faith. Let's turn to Revelation 13 first, and let's read an example of something that happens here. And let's discuss this faith in the end time. Let's go into what kind of faith will be required in the end time. And I think it'll be very interesting to see what God says in his Bible. Now, during the end time, there's a lot of events that will happen. There's a lot of things that are going to take place. Revelation 13 in verse 4, we'll read through this one section. It says, so they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. So we see here there's a beast power first that's set up. And not only is it just set up, but the beast power is actually allowed to do certain things, given authority. In other words, Satan is the one who powers the beast power, but he couldn't be allowed to do something unless God allowed these things to happen. And you'll notice what happens is this beast, his beast power starts to speak great blasphemy, starts to do incredible things. And we read in other places that this great beast power actually does incredible signs and miracles, that there's going to be things that look like they're, you know, incredible miracles or incredible things that people say, wow, that is amazing. And they'll be fueled by, you know, Satan's power basically behind this beast power. Now, verse 7 is very interesting because it says it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Now, there's a period of time that it talks about here that it says that this beast power will be granted. Like, this couldn't happen unless it was okayed to happen. That he'll make war with the saints and overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. And in verse 10 he says, he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity, and he who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So this indicates that at a point at the end, that there will be a time in history that the saints will be made war with, and it says he will be allowed to overcome them. Now that could mean quite a few different things. Like that could mean that, you know, maybe his saints in his church are doing a work, or maybe miracles start to happen at the end time, but there'll be a period of time where the balance is going to shift, or God will allow the balance to shift. He'll allow the beast power to start to make war, and then he'll allow that to overcome the saints, or maybe that, you know, his power, the miracles that the beast power is doing, are far greater or far in proportion than what, you know, God's people are allowed to do at that time. It says here that there will be a definite balance shift at that time. Now, if you stop to think about that, you have to think about what that's going to feel or look like going into that. Because those who are God's people will have to be pretty sure of quite a few things before you hit that time. If you reach that time, and all of a sudden that the beast power starts to overpower and perform miracles and do things that maybe even against the church and allow to happen, is that a time where we'll start to cave or waver or start to think that, wow, what's going on here? What's happening? So when Christ makes the statement, when I return to the earth, will I find faith? He's starting to speak about a lot of these events that will be very intense, these events that will be not trivial, and these events that will be so incredibly intense that it will require a lot of faith to make it through them. You'll notice what's happening at that time. You know, the entire world is worshiping this beast power. That means every single person around you, and this is not talking about like, you know, just over in Europe. This is saying like if you were to walk out your front door, the neighbor on your left and your right will be wrapped up in this whole concept. The people that are around you in your block will be, you know, this beast power, this thing is incredible. And they will give into it. They will give into the power. And it says in other places, you know, that there's a mark assigned there. And those who have the mark, it says those who have the mark are pretty much everyone except for those who are of the Lamb of God or those who are his chosen ones. Those who have the mark will be able to buy and sell. Now, that means that, you know, there'll be a time that maybe you actually end up losing your job and not able to get one, because you're not part of this beast power, but yet your neighbors do. And that your neighbors will then turn and say, look, this person must be of God or something like God, because look at the great miracle signs and things that are going on around this person. There has to be something to that. The whole world will be into that. What type of faith is required in those situations? It's going to be very, very important to have a deep faith in there. There's different places where, you know, it says here that, you know, he who takes captive, you know, will be led into captivity, or, you know, he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity, and he who kills with a sword will be killed with a sword. This could indicate there may be some periods of time where it gets pretty rough. There may be some captivities, you know, or there may be some, you know, killings, but it says what is the patience and the faith of the saints is that God says that he who does these things will, that will happen to them. The person who took into captivity will be taken into captivity. The person who killed will be killed with the sword. So God is indicating that at that time of intense pressure, that the saints will have a patience during that time. Patience will be required and a great faith, knowing that God is the one who will exact the revenge on that. Let's look at another one in Revelation. Let's go to Revelation 14, next chapter over, and we'll kind of read on. Revelation 14, 9 through 12. It says, then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives his mark in his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast in his image and who receive the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints again. Here is another indication where there's the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. You notice those two things again are mentioned in the same context. That there will be a time where patience will be required. If the tables turn and we pray to God and God allows certain things to happen, there will be an incredible patience and faith that will be required to make it through some of those things. That's exactly what this is talking about. And the faith that it's also describing is knowing that even though these things are happening temporarily, that even though the balance swung the other way, it's going to swing completely back the other way. And God is the one that will take care of. And those who worship the beast in his image will be the ones who will all of a sudden be flipped over and on the bad side of things now. In verse 12 it says, again, here's the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep his commandments and have the faith of Christ. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. So what does that mean? You know, what does some of those statements mean? The one where it says that, you know, they rest from their labors and their works follow them means that basically there'll be a time where the actions of his saints will be made evident, right? The faith of the saints will be demonstrated by incredible actions. So there will be this struggle where the saints will have great faith and do great actions based on that. And like it said, that, you know, if there are some that are killed, and this, if you look at history, this has happened in the past many times, where there are his disciples or his apostles have been killed before, that they are resting from their labors or that faith and the actions based on that faith, and that their works follow them really means that they have left a legacy. The legacy they left says that all of these actions they did demonstrated a faith in the God who says that I will overturn and overcome this beast power. So when it says that their works follow them, that means that it laid down a track record, that their faith was demonstrated throughout that time, and their works follow on to them. People understand that they had great faith in God. Now, Christ also mentioned something else in another place, that he says his disciples are not above the teacher. You know, his disciples are not above what the teacher goes through. This could mean a lot of different things. This could mean persecutions. Christ went through many persecutions. This could mean, you know, wrongful accusations. And in some cases, it could mean death. I'm not saying it means that in every case. But it means that those who follow him are going to basically have done to them a lot of the same things that happened to Christ. The wrongful accusations, the intense wrongdoing that can happen from that in death and even some cases, that the disciples who follow him will experience some of the same things that the teacher experienced before as well. So with some of those things in mind, we have to understand and prepare our minds. It's very important to prepare now, because if you see and understand that there will be some intense times that are coming, what's required to make it through those is demonstrated in the Bible, and it says there's a patience and a faith of the saints to make that through. What I'd like to do is to dig into that and to help us to understand really, you know, what that faith and that patience is, or the faith of the saints, so that we can be prepared for that time, be prepared for the intense times. We know and we see on the world scene things just escalating. We see things happening all the time. Let's read Psalm 91, and you can read a description that applies to today. Think about this in today's context. In Psalm 91, in verse 1 through 12, this is a psalm, but it's talking about the faith in God and God's protection. And think about this when you think about what's happening today in the world scene, with the terrorism and other things that are coming. Verse 1 said, He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by the day, nor of the pestilence that walks in the darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. Does that describe anything that we've seen so far? You think that would describe anything else that's also coming? Verse 7 is very interesting. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near to you. 1,000 people may fall around you and 10,000 at your right side, but it will not come near to you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked, because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all of your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against the stone. Now, think of those scriptures in the context of what we know is coming. Right? Think about when it says, 1,000 fall around you or 10,000. What if something happened in your city or in your area? What if somebody detonated a biological weapon in your neighborhood or in the city that you're in? Is it the gas masks and things that we need to be prepared with? Because what this scripture is saying to us is that these things will come, and they will come right up to your doorstep and all around you. But yet God, if you trust and have that faith in Him as your shield and your buckler, you may see 10,000 people fall around you, but it won't strike you. That is very, very important. This is describing the same thing. This is describing the same time, and this is also describing a faith that you have to have for that. Because it says, I have made God my shield and my buckler. I have made God the one that I have declared that He is the one that will protect me. He is the one that will block things out. And that is a trust or a faith that must be established to go through these things. Because we know that there is going to be a time of trial on this earth that will try men like never before. And there will be things that we will see. Christ said up until the tribulation, there will be wars and rumors of war and intense times, but the end is not quite yet. So things are going to get very, very bad before the actual tribulation happens, before God's people are rescued or, to a place of safety. There are some very incredible things that you will see happen. This requires a faith. To go through things like you see here and that you read here and you know here is going to require an intense amount of faith to be able to make it through. Now, this is not something that you can get to that time and just say, okay, I'm just going to be strong and work it up. What I'd like to actually prove to you today is that how you have to develop that faith right now, and exactly how that works, because that must be happening right now before you get to that time. In fact, your mindset at this moment in history needs to be that you know what's coming, I know what I'm going to run up against, I must be thinking in my mind and preparing for that moment. What good does it do you to kind of go through all of life and get to that moment and kind of cave in? So really, in a sense, you're preparing for that one moment. You're preparing for that time when things are very intense and you need that faith, the concept of faith in you to be able to make it through those things. What I'd like to show is how we actually do that. Now let's read another parable here to kind of shed some light on some of this. Matthew 25, verse 31. I know this is a parable that we've read many times before, but let's look at it just a little bit differently, because it's in the same context of the end time when you look at it, the things that are going on in this parable. And you'll see here, what's in here requires great faith. Matthew 25, 31 through 46 says, when the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory, and all the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate from one another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And He will set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on His right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in, and I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then they will answer Him and say, Lord, when did we see you hungry and sick and thirsty? Or when did we see you in prison? And the king will answer and say to them, surely I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Then he'll say to those on his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. And I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they will also say to them, when did we ever see all of these things? And he'll say, assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it, not did it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Now, the context of this parable, again, is in the end time. If you read the previous couple ones, so the five virgins, the parable of the talents, and then when Christ returns, he'll say these things to people. You can interpret this a couple ways, and it's very important to interpret a couple ways as well, because it has a spiritual meaning. You know, a lot of times people quote that and say, well, we should be going out, you know, into the world and just kind of, you know, visiting prisons and things like that. And, you know, some of that meaning could be there, but what it's saying is, you know, you did it to the least of me, my brethren. Like, his people, basically. Clothed, gave a glass of water, you know, comforted, nourished. He's saying that if you do this to my brethren, you've done it to me. Now, on a spiritual context, you can think of that right now. Because you can think that, you know, what does it take to relieve somebody? Or what does it take to strengthen somebody? You know, sometimes it's a good word. Sometimes it's prayers. You know, what's a cup of cold water to somebody? You know, somebody's having a very difficult time or, you know, struggling with things, that you can give a bit of encouragement, that, you know, you could pray for them, or you can do something special, cook a meal for them, things like that. And you know what? Sometimes those things, in the middle of intense times, are such like a glass of cold water. Very refreshing, something that's refreshing. So think about this in the spiritual context, the spiritual dimension of refreshing as people. Now, let's apply that to that time when things are very intense. The time, like I said before, when maybe there's the beast power whose economic grip is all over this world, and only those who participate in its system are allowed to participate in the economic wealth that is there. You know, a lot of times I think we think, you know, that the beast power will come as just, you know, this evil thing. But if you read about how the beast power appeals, it says in different places that, you know, the merchants of the world were made fat or made rich off of her. In other words, the beast power is going to come on the scene offering lots of appealing things. Money, financial security, you know, incredible riches and wealth. These are the things that are going to suck people in. It's not that there's going to be necessarily the religious side of it that would suck people in, but the incredible riches in a potential of making money and just having more than enough is going to hook most people. I didn't quite understand a lot of that until, you know, starting to work at the company I work at now, at Microsoft, because there's an incredible amount of wealth and money and things that, you know, the potential is to be had there. You know, if you're willing to sacrifice your time, your life, your body, and everything else that is anything else, you can over time pretty much, you know, get ahead financially and do really well. And you know what? That is very appealing. People come in there and they're willing to sell their souls and everything that they're about to be able to get something out of it. And you see the potential there. You see that there's this incredible amount of wealth and things that could be had if you just do a few things. I didn't quite understand that because it is an incredible draw. I know when I first started working there, you know, I just put in a lot of hours just working, trying to, you know, get better, do better, you know, get the better reviews, the, you know, things like that. And there's a point in time where you have to just stop and recognize it for what it is. But that helped me to understand something. That helped me to understand that when it says the beast power is going to appeal and the merchants of this world are going to be made rich off of her, the same thing's going to happen on a worldwide scale, that people are going to all of a sudden have this placed in front of them. There will be no strings attached at first. Just kind of chip in, you know, guaranteed in 5 years everything that, you know, you ever worried about economically will be taken care of for you. People will fall for that. And I think that's going to be a huge appeal. That alone is going to take an incredible amount of faith, because why does God give scriptures in there that say, you know, I will clothe you? You know, don't fear that. I will clothe you. And other things. I think a lot of that applies more to the end time, when it's going to be very tough and when there's going to be this iron grip economic system, then coupled with the religious system and a branding with the power of the beast, that's going to be a very hard thing for people around you. They won't break out of it. They will fall for it. They won't care, and they won't care what goes along with it. But for us to go against that is going to mean going against the economic power that's there as well. Being willing to give it up, being willing to, you know, be the one in your neighborhood that maybe is the one struggling. it's something to think about. I think if you look at the beast power, there's going to be an intense amount of economic pull to the actual beast power. And so the faith required to give it up, step out on your own, and trust in God is going to be tremendous in the end time. Now, what this is saying here, too, in this parable, it says, did you see me, take me in, and, when I was sick or in prison? There could be a time, what if some of us in this congregation are singled out? What if some of us in here, maybe not everyone, a few people, their beliefs are exposed? People all of a sudden understand that you believe in the Sabbath day and the holy days and everything that goes against what the beast power and the religious system that's set up there says, and these people are exposed. That could mean public persecutions. That could mean that they're thrown in prison. You could get to a point where they might be thrown in prison. Now, what would be required on your part? Think about that. If some people around you all of a sudden are exposed to this intense scrutiny and are in prison, would you have the faith to stand up and make a stand with them or not? That's part of what this parable is saying. Would you be willing to, against all scrutiny and public opinion and things that are going on, walk in to the prison, to God's brethren, and give them a cup of cold water, give them something that's encouraging, give them something that's uplifting, at the risk of being persecuted, knowing that everybody's looking at you? There's going to be a choice that we'll have to make at some point when things get pretty intense, to be able to make a stand for God and to feed and to care for His people. And I think we'll see those, like it said, those who are His will have a great love for the brethren. You'll see this come out at the end time when things are very intense and people are suffering. Some are, some aren't. Those who aren't will have to make the decision to go help them. Step out on faith, knowing there could be ramifications, but also knowing that God is your buckler, your shield, and your protector. That type of thing is what I'm talking about, requiring a great amount of faith. There will be an incredible amount that is required of us to be able to do that in the context of faith. Because we will have to step out on those things. So, the faith will be required, but let's dig a little bit deeper and understand, exactly what is the faith and kind of the process of how it works. I think it's very important to understand and to make it very clear that what faith is really all about. Because I think sometimes we can misthink what it is or how it works. And then what we'll do is we'll tie that in, how it works to our lives today and how that applies to what I'm talking about coming in the tribulation or coming when there might be this intense time later. So let's step over. Let's kind of jump into faith. We know that it's going to be required, but how do we make that and how do we get that faith for that time? Let's go to Hebrews 11, because Hebrews 11 is a good chapter in the Bible to discuss about faith. It's called the faith chapter, and there's a lot of different examples that are in this chapter. But it also describes and points out some things about faith that help us to understand it. Hebrews 11, let's start right at the beginning, and we'll go through a few scriptures here. It says, now, verse 1, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, for by it the elders obtained a good testimony. So let's stop right there. If you look at the word faith, if you look that up in the Greek, the word is pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S, and it's translated a number of ways in the Bible. It's usually translated faith. Sometimes you can translate it assurance. You'll also see it translated believe or belief or them that believe in different places as well. So sometimes when you're reading through the Bible and it says, he believed on God, that's the same kind of word. It could be the same word or it's the same meaning where it says he had faith in God. So believe and faith sometimes are used interchangeably in the Bible. But this word usually is translated faith and believe in different places. Now, so there's a belief there. Now, if you look at it, there's a couple other words that are here. It says, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. That is a very important sentence to understand, what it means. So the substance, sometimes it's translated assurance. You can see that translated assurance in different translations. But that word there, which is substance or assurance, is hypostasis. And basically what that means is, it's translated different ways. Again, sometimes it's competence, confident, you know, substance, different places. But what it really means is it's a setting or a placing under, a thing put under. So it's kind of like a foundation. So foundation of your house, right? What is that? Concrete. So if you're looking at building a house, the thing that goes under, the setting under, the thing that gives the substance and the foundation for everything else is what is called faith. A thing put under, the substructure, the foundation, that which has a foundation, which is firm. You know, it has an actual existence. It's an actual substance. It's a being. It has a substantial quality or nature to it, right? It's a steadfastness. So when you read the understanding of that word, assurance, as a foundation, it's really a tangible thing. A lot of times we think of faith as kind of an emotion, right? You know, I kind of have faith or I don't have faith. And what this is saying, and if you look at the description and the definition of this, is there's really nothing in here that would describe that this is just an emotion, right? This is just kind of emotion. What it's saying is it's a real substance. Faith is a substance, right? It's a substance of what? Of things hoped for. And then the word evidence is elenkos. Yes, I speak Greek very fluently. elenkos. And basically, the word evidence here is reproof, or, you know, evidence is actually a good word for it, proof by which things are proved or tested, right? You know, think of kind of in a court of law, right? What they do is they present a body of evidence. They say, look, here are all of these things, and all of these things prove this. So what faith is all of these things, or the evidence. Again, that's not describing the emotion. It's not saying it's a, you know, a feeling, an emotion, or it's not even just an intellectual thing. It's actually saying it has substance, and it's an evidence. It's evidence of something else. So it's something that is of substance and can be grown or developed. I mean, we see this at different places in the Bible, that faith is actually grown and developed. In another place, when God is talking about the armor of God, he calls it the shield of faith. He says that it's a shield. And that actually is good to understand, or help us to understand how it works, because it is described as a shield or something that can block. And what it blocks, it says, is it quenches the fiery darts of Satan. Now, if you look at kind of past wars, the way that they were fought, I know that we've come a long way since then, you know, the way that we militarily do things. But what they used to have back in some of the wars are something that are called fiery darts, or just another name for a dart is an arrow, right? Dart or an arrow. And what they would do is they would dip the front of an arrow in some sort of kind of flammable, you know, substance, tar or something like that. And then they would light it on fire. And then as the people were lined up on the other side, they would shoot these flaming arrows, or fiery darts, they called them, you know, right into the ranks of the enemy. Now, it's not that it was just there to kind of hit and catch fire. That's part of what the damage that was done. But it was really meant to unsettle the enemy. It was really meant to kind of throw them off balance, because when you looked at from the point of view of where you're standing there and it's coming at you, the way that the flame kind of flickers or flies, you can't really tell where this arrow is going to land, right? It's just kind of like doing this type of a thing is what it looks like from the front. So it's very wobbly. And so what would happen is people seeing those coming couldn't quite gauge where they're going to land, and it would cause them to kind of panic is what would happen. They would kind of, you know, you're just trying to focus on that. And that was the other intent of what these fiery darts were intended to do, is to panic the enemy, to send kind of, you know, fear into them and make them kind of just give it up. And that's the analogy that God uses here when he's talking about Satan. Satan's fiery darts are meant to do the same thing to us. Satan's fiery darts are things that he lodges at us or kind of lofts at us. We see them coming, and they're hard to figure out. They're hard to understand. They may not make sense. They may be very difficult, right? They may be a lot of different things. But that fiery dart is what he fires at us. And what God says is the thing that prevents that is raising the shield of faith. Let me explain a little bit more in just a second. But it's not talking about emotion, because there's no emotion that's going to protect you through those things. There's no emotion that will protect you through Satan's fiery darts. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to be strong, because that's, you know, I'm going to be strong, or I'm going to psych myself up. only last until you get tired or, you know, something happens, and then your emotion kind of dies down. So faith is a real substance, a thing that we can really raise, and a thing that grows and can prevent those things. So let's dig. What is that? Like, when it says that it's evidence of things not seen, you know, think about kind of like the wind, right? Do you know that air exists? Maybe you do. I mean, maybe scientifically it's been proven and things like that, but I think if you look around you, you can't really see it. It's something that's unseen. But there are some evidences that we have that show us that air does exist. One of those evidences is that there's wind, right? When you feel the wind, you say, oh, you know, that's part of the air, or it's blowing on me, right? And that same kind of way, the wind is evidence of something that's not seen. So faith then, again, is an evidence, not an emotion, but a real live evidence of something that's not seen. So raising the shield of faith, when you come upon a fiery dart or something that's coming at you that's, you know, difficult, or maybe a trial that doesn't seem to have an end, or things that maybe throw you off. Just think of something that throws you off spiritually. What is it that throws you off spiritually? Makes you kind of dip down into like an attitude, or just stumble and not, you know, kind of understand what's going on? Those are fiery darts that are lofted at us. So raising the shield of faith is saying that I know, you know, that in the past, God has worked in my life. You have seen, you have known that what God has done. You have seen times in your past where maybe God has intervened for you, that you understand that maybe it came right up to the last second. Maybe it was the hardest thing you've ever gone through, but there was a point in time where God broke through that for you, gave you a wide open space, and that you know, or you've collected some evidence that God is in your life and He's working. So what happens is when you have some faith on something, that is a bit of the evidence that gets collected. Again, you don't drum it up. You know in your mind and your heart what has happened in the past. You know that you've seen God. You've seen Him call you out of this world. You've seen your mind open. You've seen your spirit been given. You've seen Him rescue you out of different trials. All of that is evidence that in your mind and your heart, you know and you understand. It is not an intellectual argument. You can't just sit there and kind of convince yourself like, oh, you know, logically it should be this. It's evidence that you've amassed over time. It's evidence that you've amassed over time. Why is that important? Why does it have to be evidence that you've amassed over time? The reason that's important is because you're not going to get to a point in the future and just say, I'm going to have faith now. Right? It doesn't just come. It's very important to think about now, because we need to start amassing that evidence now, because it will get very intense later. You can't all of a sudden, if you're sitting there now thinking, you know, I will just kind of put this off or change this at some point, you know, I'll see the way things are going and at that point I'll put this off, or I'll address this issue, or I'll kind of really get my act together. It won't work like that. It's too late at that point. What faith is saying is that you have to amass a collection of evidence as you go. That means today, that means this week, that means next week. Because faith is not an emotion that you can just come up with like that. Faith is a calm assurance or a foundation that's laid all along. You know what? The way you exercise that is in your day-to-day life. I used to struggle with this concept. I remember praying a lot of times. I asked God, you know, could you help with this thing and with that thing? And after a while, you know, I would be reading the news or watching TV or just reading about, you know, tremendous things that other people in this world are going through. And I, you know, would stack those two together and say, you know, God can't be interested in this. You know, it's so insignificant. Look how great our lives are in this country. How is He interested in, you know, helping us through, you know, the next paycheck or things like that? You know, we've got so much here already. But understanding faith, I had to stop and think that it's not necessarily that thing that God's interested in. But if you are trying to rely on God and build faith, God is very interested in that. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's something in your job that's troubling you and you recognize that and you go to God and want to learn faith from Him, I'll tell you what, God will answer that, because He is very interested in you developing faith. Not necessarily interested in giving you, you know, every single piece of thing that you want, but what I'm saying is that don't discount those things. Those are opportunities that when we go to God, God wants us to come to Him, and He wants to teach us faith. It's very important to understand that we can go and we can ask those things. So to raise that shield of faith then is not an emotional thing. It's saying a fiery dart hits me, I don't understand, it's pretty scary, but I understand how God has worked in my life in the past. I know that I was up against a situation before, I was pressed to the wall, it looked like there was no out, but God delivered me. This looks the same. I will have confidence in that God, and the one who is my shield, my buckler, and my faith. But you can't say that unless you've been collecting that evidence. Right? It's something that you know, and you know what? It's only you. I can't give you faith. I can't come to you and say, I can encourage you, yes. But I can't just come to you and give you faith. That is something that you and God have to build. You have to build that faith in God. God wants us to build that, and God works in our lives. And I think a lot of times that's why we have a lot of the trials we have. Like, let them work in our lives. Let them work, because it says, the trying of your patience, produces patience. And that is a trying of your faith. And that is a lot of the reason why we have, because that faith is more precious to God, and God will take us through things. And that's why He'll also take us through things in the end time. Did ancient Israel ever think that they're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years? They wouldn't have left if they did. Right? God said, I will take you to the promised land. You know what? He did. But He also took them a roundabout way to try and test their heart. And it says it was not mixed with belief or faith. They didn't have the faith. I think sometimes we have to look at the end time that, we may have it pictured a certain way in our minds, and there are certain promises God does say in His Bible, but there may be events that happen to us that we didn't anticipate or think about. And we need to prepare ourselves and have the faith, like ancient Israel went through the wilderness, and to understand that you may take a different turn that you didn't plan on, but that faith is required. Israel's example is written so that we don't make that same mistake today. This is the same reason why you can't argue with someone, about faith in God. Because when you collect a body of evidence, it's personal to you. That evidence is personal to you. You know the times God has done things in your life. You see that. You cannot convince somebody else intellectually that to have faith on that. Right? If you're arguing with somebody who does not believe in God, you cannot convince them. Because you know you have a substance. That's why it says faith is the substance of things hoped for, an evidence of things not seen. You're collecting the evidence. You know for sure. Faith is that sure thing. They don't have that same faith or that evidence in their lives. So you can't convince that person unless they have been doing the exact same thing as you go along. So it's very important for us to think about that. Think about that in our day-to-day lives. Ask God to help you learn faith. Also ask for His mercy, because He'll definitely teach you. Right? I mean, I have to ask that. I have to ask that God would help me to see, but I also have to ask Him, please don't just let it all come down on me at once, right? But He will teach you, and you will grow in that, and you will learn those things. It's like you can't become a bodybuilder all at once, right? You can't all of a sudden one day say, I'm a bodybuilder, if you've never been working out. Like, you don't all of a sudden have muscles or something like that. Now, that's kind of a simple analogy, but it's the same type of a concept here, what faith is. Faith is collecting the evidence as you go. We are collecting evidence. We've seen a lot of miracles and things happen in our church with people we know. Your calling is a miracle. Reflect back on these things that you've seen God working in your life. Hold those in your mind and know for sure, because there'll become a time, like it says, what if the beast power is allowed to overcome the saints and do great miraculous works? Will you say, boy, that looks like God's doing that, or I'm confused? Or will you know in your heart exactly what has gone on in your life and who you are? Faith is a cornerstone idea of who you are and knowing during those times. So we have to understand this day to day, live this day to day. Sometimes you can argue with somebody who has the emotional brand of faith. They're just all worked up and they have faith, but that's a very shallow faith. They may agree with you, but when it comes to the trials and the persecutions, it says, woe, there will be offenses. Woe to him whom offenses come. But are the roots shallow so that person will just give up the faith? So let's continue on in Hebrews here. Hebrews verse 3, it says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen are not made of which are visible." So the word there for ages, again, is the word aeon, A-I-O-N. And it's forever, an unbroken age, perpetuity of time. It also means the worlds of the universe. So it carries actually a dual meaning. It does mean the physical worlds, you know, the earth and the universe and things out in outer space. But there's also another meaning there. The ages, the times that we live in, the times of man, that God framed those, that God's hand is in those things, that God, through the time in the history, has crafted and brought things a certain way for the time of Christ, for the end time, that God rules in the age of man, that God crafts those things. So the intent, that's an important thing to understand, because it means that God crafts and knows and has architected what we see around us and where we are going for a specific reason. There's a great faith that we can have in that. There must be a purpose for those things. And why is it important is found in verse 6. So Hebrews 11:6, it says, "Without faith it is impossible to please him. For who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." So this is a way that we stand before God pleasing. He wants to see people operating. He wants a people who will step out in faith and are of this mindset. That's very pleasing to him. That's something that he smiles at. When you do that, when you step out and when you try it, despite all that's going on around you, he's pleased at that. He smiles at you. Right? That's a very pleasing thing in his sight. You know, the Bible points out a lot of reasons why it's important to have faith, and we won't go through all of them, but, you know, it says that we're justified by faith. We stand before God just out of faith. It's not by what we do, not by our actions, but what we do. Ancient Israel wasn't allowed to enter in because of their unbelief, so it calls out the importance of being able to enter into his kingdom is a matter of faith at that time. The Bible also says the just shall live by faith. Those who are just, justified before God, live their lives by faith. And there's a lot of other things that the Bible points out. But let's continue on, because there's a very important part of Hebrews in verse 13 that explains a bit more about this. It says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, they were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they are strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind the country from which they come out of, they would have had opportunity to return, but now desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." Why is that important? This is mentioned as a tenet of what all of these people in the Bible who had faith had, is they had their eyes fixed. It's not just a matter, if we read this actually very carefully, it's not just a matter of saying, you know, I'm looking forward to the kingdom. That's not what it's saying there. Read verse 15 again. It says, "Truly, if they had called to mind the country which they had come out of," which means, that actually literally means that they are no longer part of this world's kingdom, but now they are part of God's kingdom today, which means they are under its jurisdiction and its rule. It says they've come out of this world, of this kingdom. They're looking for a heavenly country. They're actually looking for the homeland, the actual physical instance when it comes to the earth. But if you look at the what it's talking about there, it's saying that they're actually under the jurisdiction of the kingdom of God today. That means that they are in line underneath the rule of the kingdom, and that you can call on the rule of that kingdom in today's world, because that kingdom rules over this world. So it goes beyond just saying, I'm looking forward to a kingdom. That's part of it, looking forward to when it actually happens. But saying and understanding, you understand that you're no longer a member of this world's kingdom, but you are sitting underneath the jurisdiction and the rule of God's kingdom today. And you can call up the chain, and you're obedient down the chain to that rule of command that is there. That's what they had firmly fixed in their minds. Not just looking for a kingdom, but they're a part of that today. That's why they left. They actually looked for when the homeland, you know, when the actual physical kingdom would come, and the city does come. That's part of it. But that's an important distinction, because that's a cornerstone of faith. If you turn really quickly, let me just find out where this is. We'll look at a parable very quickly. Matthew 8. Let's turn there very quickly. Matthew 8, verse 5. I've always wondered about this parable. I read it many times, and I said, why is that great faith? God calls out to this person that they have great faith. This is Matthew 8, verse 5. It says, when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant's lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said to him, I will come to him and heal him. The centurion answered, and he said, Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed. Right? And then what he said next, Christ said in verse 10, he says, Jesus heard it and he marveled and he said to those who followed, assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not in Israel. What was the statement that he said? Well, he said, wow, I've never seen that such great faith. That's verse 9. He says, I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and another one, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. Christ said, this is the greatest faith you've seen. Why? Because that man understood the invisible kingdom concept. He said, I have people above me and below me. I understand that's exactly what you have. I understand that you are the king of a kingdom and that you have God the Father above you and you have people below you. And you say, go and do this. I understand and see that invisible kingdom. And Christ said, wow, I have not seen such great faith, because that man's eyes could see the invisible kingdom and Christ was the king of that. Therefore, he knew that he just had to speak the word and then his servant could be healed. That's what that parable means. That's what it's saying there. I've always wondered that, but that's exactly what it's saying, and that is a great amount of faith. And we see that mentioned time and time again throughout the book of Hebrews, of how that's how what the people had in their minds as well. So let's go on for a couple more things about faith, and let's just understand a couple things. Now, there are a couple of enemies, or four enemies of faith mentioned in the Bible, and I'm not going to turn to these, but it's very interesting to point out that Christ helps us to understand that there are things that will war against your faith and bring your faith down. Let me give you the references to those. The first one is Matthew 8:23. Basically, four times in the Bible, Christ says, there's an event, and he says, oh, you of little faith, like you have little faith. And he says something, why did you do this? He says that four times. So what we do is we've grouped that together as four enemies of faith, things that were described as people who had little faith. The first one is Matthew 8:23. It's fear. It says, why are you fearful of little faith? And the example was, in the boat with the wind and the waves. So fear is definitely something that's in our lives. We can think physically waves, but think spiritually waves, things that rock your boat, your household, your spiritual life. Those are spiritual waves. Right, and those can be quite fearsome. Christ is saying, fear is something that will cause you not to have faith. The second thing that he says, oh, you have little faith, is Matthew 14:25. He says, oh, you have little faith, why did you doubt? So this is when Peter was walking on the water. He says, why did you doubt, you have little faith? That's the second enemy of faith. And the reason Peter doubted is because he did see those wind and those waves. He did fear, and then he doubted. So faith requires us to not be able to doubt, to be able to suspend these emotions, to put them on the side. Because around you, there may be waves and wind. But faith is saying, I see those, but I believe God. I have my eyes fixed on Christ, even though I see those wind and those waves. Peter doubted, and that's when he, sank into the water. sometimes these things, wind and waves, will stretch us beyond what we think. Have you ever thought, this is all I can take in a trial? God said he wouldn't give me more than I can take. Haven't you gone past that many times? That's happened. That happens a lot. And I think that's a hard thing for us to work with. And I think that those wind and those waves, they don't stop sometimes. And this is a thing that can happen. But doubting is something that wars against our faith. The third enemy is in Matthew 6:25. He says, don't worry about your clothing. He will clothe you, O you of little faith. So he's talking about in this scripture, anxious care or worry. So we have fear, doubt, and anxious care. And what is anxious care? It's basically just worrying. Kind of sitting there and, oh man, this could happen, or what if this happened, or what if that, your voice kind of gets whiny, and you start thinking about, all these things that, could happen to you. That's the concept of anxious care. You're just continually being consumed by that. Well, that's something that wars against the faith as well. So the third one is anxious care, right? And that's a big one. That's a big one today. A lot of pressures on our lives today. Making money, having a home, making a paycheck to paycheck. We can be consumed by these things very easily. It's very easy to be consumed. And the fourth one is Matthew 16, verse 5. The fourth one is Matthew 16, verse 5, where they were arguing over the bread, and it says, you know, you have little faith, why do you reason among yourselves? So the fourth one is human reasoning. And human reasoning is just basically saying that, you know, before you're going to actually have faith, you're going to try and figure it out. Like, I'm going to reason, this is what's going on, or this is why it's happening, or this is, you know, this and that. Right? And a lot of times we are not going to get the answer. I know with our trial with our son, in the beginning, we got no answers why it happened. We went back and looked at evidence, and we tried to figure things out, but you know what? It was almost as if God said, I'm not going to tell you why, just trust me. And I remember that because I remember taping him. I had some videotape of him when he first started, and the doctor wanted to see the videotape, you know, to kind of diagnose maybe what happened or what the problem was. And I went back and to show them the videotape, and somehow it got taped over. It was just very uncanny. All the things that we went back to try and figure it out, it was like God was saying, you know what? I'm not going to tell you why. You know, trust me on that. And so in some ways what human reasoning is talking about is you just reasoning, trying to, you know, before you're going to believe, you as a person can figure it out. A lot of ways we have to let that go. So these four enemies of faith, fear, doubt, anxious care or worry, and human reasoning, are things that when you start to see them consume in your life, those are things that can overwhelm. Now, let me give you a tip on dealing with those, because do you have those emotions? I do. I have those emotions a lot, right? Those are natural human things that you go through. But like James says, you know, faith isn't made perfect until there's works. You know, it says faith without works is dead, right? You know, you all know that scripture. Faith isn't made perfect, you know, without the works. The same way with these things, right? They're not brought to maturity unless they have works that accompany them. You know, when James said, you know, you say you have faith, and I will show you my faith by my works. Let me paraphrase that for fear. Right? Fear is made perfect with works. Right? To paraphrase James, you know, you profess that you're afraid, but you go around acting confident without a trace of being timid or pulling back. You're not being made perfect with fear. You say you fear, well, I'll show you my fear by my works and my cowering and my lack of confidence. In other words, the emotion might be there at start, but it's what you really do in spite of that emotion, right? Despite that emotion, that will kind of bear its fruit in your actions. So the point is that you may have fear in those things, but the point is to act and move on faith, right? You've heard it probably said, I don't know, that, you know, courage isn't the lack of fear, but courage is moving despite your fear. And it's the same with these. Faith isn't a lack of fear necessarily. It's being able to move and get your body moving and obey God and do the right thing despite that fear that you have, you know, that's in your body. And the point about that is the more you do that over time, that emotion will become less and less. So don't confuse the two. Don't just let that emotion trip you up. If that emotion's there, look to God, fix your eyes, read the Bible, what he says, and move. Take the action. Just like I said, faith without the works is dead. And that action is the thing that proves where your mind is. What action you're taking proves where your mind is. And God sees that and he knows that. All right, so let's keep on moving with that. So let me look at one thing. One more thing. Let's turn to Luke 18, verse 9. Let's wrap this up with a couple things. This will be a time where it's very intense. Another parable in the Bible that Christ brings out something very interesting about faith. You know, this one is right near the parable that we read in the beginning. Will he find faith on this earth? And what's very interesting is when you read something like that in the Bible, look at the parables around it, because Christ is trying to explain that concept even more in depth. It's true with this parable. This parable seems completely unrelated to faith, but it's very related. We all know this one. Luke 18, verse 9. He says, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus within himself, You know, God, I thank you that I'm not like the other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess. And the tax collector standing afar off would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. This parable gives you a tremendous key about growing in faith. Faith is not grown until you're in humility, in a humility state of mind here. What does it mean to be justified before God? What he's saying here is you can't come before God and say, look, I did all these things. There's never a point where you kind of have, you know, done enough and come to God and say, I've done all these things. You come to God by grace through faith. These two are at odds. The person came up and laid out what they did. The other person said, look, God, I am a sinner, and that's how I am before you. In humility, as a sinner. Do you want to grow in faith? You approach God that way every time. As soon as you come to a point where you think you deserve something because of what you did, then you've tread over into the other line. No matter what you do and how much you do, you come to God and you say, I am a sinner. I stand before you in grace, in your faith, your grace, and I call on that grace. If you have complete faith and confidence in that, not yourself and what you do, things will act and happen in your life. That is what will be required as well at the end time. Not us to come and tell God how great we are, but for us to come to God in humility. As soon as you think about this parable and start to understand that, you will start to grow in faith. Look at the parables around that. So let's finish off by reading where we started. So let's go back to Luke 18, where he says, you know, will he really find faith on the earth? And let's finish with this parable, Luke 18, verse 1. And you'll notice that this is in the context of the end time. Think about all that we've talked about so far. The incredible intense times that will be there. The things that may happen, people getting singled out, the beast power and its great power that will come on the scene, and the intense maybe persecution that may be there for us in, as church members. And he says, he spoke a parable to them in verse 1, that men always ought to pray and not to lose heart. That will be something that will be very much needed at the end time. There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, get justice for me from my adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterwards he said within himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge says. Shall not God avenge his own elect, who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? He says, I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? So this parable, think about this as you think about what's coming. There will be some tough times ahead. There will be. The context is the end time. And it says that if, you know, will he find that faith? The faith that's required to make it through those things. That when we cry out to God day and night about the persecutions and things that come, it may be tough, and there may be some things that happen. There may be despisings and persecutions and maybe death for some. We don't know. But God says that he will avenge them. Understand and know that. He will bear long with his saints. It may take a little bit, but he will avenge them. So now is the time to prepare. Understand the faith and how that evidence needs to be collected as we go. And develop that deep faith. And the reason you're developing it is for that one moment. So let's take a look at that deep faith and really work that into our lives.